Hi there. Come up on the porch. We're just sitting here watching it rain and talking about Louisiana.
I'm Bruce McGee.
I'm Steve Payne.
This is the Louisiana Anthology Podcast, episode 319 for June 29th, 2019.
Welcome back.
This week we bring back a guest we'd had on before to talk about Broad Coupe. His name is Brian Wagner, and he has written a story on the tar baby, trying to trace its international circulation over the last 150 years or so since it was discovered. He points out that it was discovered in a lot of places at the same time, and so trying to track it back to its ultimate origin is a challenge. He concluded that we can't conclude. I still prefer to believe it's from Senegal, but,
I wonder, too, if it's not like, you know, we didn't bring this up on the show, but when you and I were kids and took Chaucer, a lot of the stories of Chaucer, they have a source, but a lot of them have what are called analogs, mm-hmm. where they are similar stories from other parts. Like, some of them, I'm thinking, like, they have analogs in India.
Right.
And I'll give an example. One of the famous ones, and there's a modern version of it, but is the story of death in the pile of gold. Well, that's the story of the treasure of the Sierra Madre in the film.
Right.
It's the same doggone story, but again, it's got that story, I think, has an analog in India.
Huh.
So these stories, they may spring up where people are thinking similarly about how to tell a story
right.
that reflects their values.
So it may not be spread directly from one place to
another.
Yeah,
it could be analogs of people thinking similarly. But also, like, who was it? Was it Newton and maybe Gauss or somebody, but anyhow, the two guys that rediscovered calculus.
Mm, yeah,
because
right.
it had been developed in ancient times by Archimedes or somebody, but it was forgotten for, you know, over 1,000 years or whatever.
And then right at the same time they come out
yeah,
with...
Yeah, because they were using some of the same mathematical tools
right.
and thinking similarly, so...
Now for This Week in Louisiana History.
So This Week in Louisiana History, on June 30th of 1870, the Robert E. Lee and the Natchez began their famous riverboat race. And
there's a famous painting by, what were the two people that did paintings back in the...
Was it Currier and Ives?
Yes,
maybe?
Yes, there's a famous Currier and Ives image of that you can find online.
Do we have that on that poster outside?
Yes,
we should post that.
It's probably on our, you know...
Cycle of photos
images
and images or whatever.
Come up, yeah. Now for This Week in New Orleans History, June 29th, 1967, Jane Mansfield dies in an auto crash on Chef Highway, and it was a horrible wreck too. Jane, her husband Harrison, and their son Brady were all killed. So that was a bad one. Now for This Week in Louisiana.
So This Week in Louisiana, on what is this, July the 4th through the 7th, the city of New Orleans will host the Essence Festival. This is number 25. This will be at the Superdome and other locations. The Essence Festival is known as the Party with a Purpose. It's an annual music festival which started in 1995 as a one-time event to celebrate the 25th anniversary of Essence Magazine, which is a periodical primarily targeting African-American women. This Essence Festival is the largest event celebrating African-American culture and music in the United States. Locally referred to as the Essence Fest, it has been held in New Orleans, Louisiana, since 1994, except for 2006 when it moved to Houston because of Hurricane Katrina. It was also held in Durban, South Africa in 2016. The festival features artists simultaneously performing on a main stage as well as four standing room only super lounge stages.
Super lounge, all right.
So this is a big deal.
Yeah, it is. Well, now this week's postcard from Louisiana, Hillary and the Boys play on Decatur Street.
Yeah.
you have a kind of sketchy look.
Here, I got a piece.
Well, you've got a good sound.
I know.
Thank you so much. I love the voice.
Hey,
I love the old songs.
Thank you. Where are you from?
North Louisiana, Ruston.
Okay, I got family up in Shreveport.
Oh my God! So you know where Ruston is?
Yep, Ruston, Bojerson.
You're the one from Wisconsin, right?
Yeah.
So you don't know. What's that? Earbuds. Don't leave home without them.
Sure, if you were, that was like an umbilical cord or something.
It's almost that bad.
Yeah, that's true.
If you get addicted to a smartphone, then, you know, you never want it out of arm's reach.
That's true. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, well, cool. It's cool you're in town.
What's that?
It's cool you're in town.
I know. I come here every time I can. Well, good luck down here. How long have you been here?
I've been here since the beginning of January.
Oh, wow, so you just got here.
Yeah, I guess so. Well,
do you have a circuit, or did you just come straight down from Wisconsin?
I just came straight here.
To do some music.
That's right. Yeah. It's a little cold in Wisconsin.
Oh, my God. What's your name?
Hillary.
Nice to meet you, Hillary.
What's yours?
I'm Bruce.
Hi, Bruce. Nice to meet you.
Well, welcome to Louisiana.
Thank you.
Bienvenue, Louisiana. That's about all the French I know.
Yeah, well, that's good. I'm low on French as well.
Well, you'll pick some up.
Yeah.
Pardon my French. Good luck.
Thank you.
Airflow. Just airflow. You fall in the air.
Hey, they don't do this for free, Daddy.
Hey.
I paid them.
Paid my very life.
Now on to our interview with Brian Wagner.
Okay. All right. I have the white
Steven? Steven, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Brian, are you there?
I'm here.
Great. Well, welcome. I'm Bruce McGee.
And I'm Steve Payne.
We're here today with Brian Wagner. Welcome back, Brian.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
And I guess it's been about 3 years since we talked to you last time.
Has it been that long? That's amazing.
It was April 1st, 2016.
It was some years ago.
So it was almost exactly three years ago, April 1st, 2016. So, yeah, and at the time we talked about Bras Coupés, which is very fascinating. You know, there's some history, there's some myth, there's some legend, there's, you know... But you've since then been investigating the Tar Baby, and I think you had already started work on the book at the time, and now it's out. Why don't you tell our folks the full name of it and where they can find it?
Sure. It's called The Tar Baby, A Global History. It was published by Princeton University Press in 2017. And you can find it at finer independent bookstores wherever you happen to be located.
And probably online too.
You could certainly find it online as well. I'm always encouraging people to support their local bookstores, but you can certainly find it at online retailers of various kinds as well.
Well, I think I wrote the folks at Laura Plantation when your book came out and told them they should stock it there. They've got, you know, a bookstore full of Compare Le Pen and Brer Rabbit and Tar Baby kind of items. So if you're there, pick it up.
we should try to get the even the chain bookstores here in the state and all over the place, all over Louisiana, we'll say, to stock it in their regional, you know, books of regional interest sections, because they do have those set aside areas where they stock Louisiana books.
It's possible that some of our local bookstores may not know the connection. How did you get interested in the Tar Baby story as a topic of research?
It's a story that I can't remember when I first knew it. I'm young enough that I didn't have the context that, say, my parents' generations and others had of the Disney movie Song of the South, which for a lot of people was the first point of contact. The origin for this book is actually a little bit more, about my academic research, in that I was surprised to learn that in the 1880s, so really soon after Joel Chandler Harris publishes his version of the story, first in the Atlantic Constitution newspaper, and then in his first collection of Uncle Remus stories, Right. That the story was it was a kind of object of profound interest among folklorists and anthropologists. And so it's really a lot of the book is in a lot of ways a kind of intellectual history of the ways in which the tar baby story has been essential to thinking about culture and history and politics for the past century and a half. So it kind of started there.
Kind of the perfect meme, because you can trace its origin and then the ripples, and it's almost like, you know, showing the spread of an idea or a disease or anything like that, the way people contact other people and how it changes over time.
I've heard those things like that called storytelling devices. You know, it's like the character itself becomes a device.
I think my first experience with the tar baby story was probably Bugs Bunny. I imagine there was a version of that in him, although I can't bring it to mind right now. But he was certainly a character based on Br'er Rabbit and Compare with him. You know,
he's a trickster figure, and you know, and so it absolutely comes out of the same tradition. You know, so the tar baby story being, you know, and this is again according to kind of what collectors and others were thinking at the time. They very much saw this story as a kind of keystone to the entire trickster tradition, which is obviously much larger. Features various animals, can feature human characters as well, and all, that whole tradition feeds directly. Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. You know, it's cool. But that feeds into the Warner Brothers cartoons, you know, mid-century, including Bugs Bunny, as well as, you know, various kinds of mass culture at that moment.
Well, and like you say, Songs of the South with Disney, but that had kind of gone out of circulation as a kid. And I think I'm older than you.
It is, in fact, still out of circulation, Disney, because of it's, you know, the film is perceived to be, I think, correctly, you know, not only insensitive, but you can just say racist. And so they have put it in the vault, and they do not allow it to circulate commercially. There are bootleg copies, you know, that are still around, but there's no kind of official outlet for that film presently.
Like every few years, Snow White will reemerge. You know, they take it out of the vault, circulate it, on the DVD.
Except that in this case, they're not taking it out of the vault. It just stays.
Right.
It just
right.
stays there. It has been.
Yeah.
And because the Br'er Rabbit version is a bit problematic because of the Uncle Remus stereotype, which kind of lacking in the Compare Le Pen version, as far as I can tell. I'm not that it's good with French Creole, and I think that's probably true of most people. Did you learn French Creole to read the Compare Le Pen version, or did you?
I have French, but I don't, you know, my linguistic skills are not that precise in that case. Let me address that. I think you raise a very important question, because it's kind of interesting the degree to which the version associated with Uncle Remus has kind of monopolized people's attention, when precisely as you indicate, there are so many versions of it. You know, there's the Compare Le Pen version in Creole French collected, and there are versions of it. The one that I talk about is collected by Calvin Claudel, but there are also versions that exist on, you know, five continents, you know, hundreds of versions of this story. And so part of what I'm interested in, I think rightly people have worried about the characterization of Uncle Remus as a kind of stereotype. Mm-hmm. And that's the kind of all the problems there, though, have to do with the frame narrative that was invented by Joel Chandler Harris, and not, you know, not the story itself, which pre-exists Joel Chandler Harris's fictional framework. And so one of the things I was interested in doing is really thinking about the global circulation of the story itself, apart from its instantiation in late 19th century literature and in mass culture, including Song of the South, where I do think it's right to say that, you know, the kind of frame there is distorting and disturbing. But there's a story in a longer tradition there that I think is kind of amazing, and I thought it deserved more attention. And again, for me, like, part of what was interesting about it was that it was so central in the years when people were just professionalizing the study of folklore and the study of culture in the late 19th century. The story, you know, they looked at other kind of key questions. The spirituals was another one. But they literally, if you look at the first issue of the Journal of American Folklore, they have a whole special section on the question of the origin of the tar baby story.
Wow.
Right? You know, and there's a whole debate that's... Go ahead.
Al C. Forche was one of the founders and the president of the MLA, and he's the one that collected the French, you know, Creole version. And so it wasn't just folklorists. This is the MLA, you know.
Absolutely. Well, at the time there was no boundary between the two.
Right.
You have a lot of people who, you know, the child ballads and such were objects of interest for any member of the MLA. You know, in the 1890s when Forche was there. Go ahead.
You go a few miles out of the city you're living in, you know, teaching at Tulane, and hear these stories he had heard when he was a kid, and nobody's writing them down. Nobody's ever written them down. And he writes them down, and he translates them. So, you know, think about the contribution.
A bit like the Brothers Grimm, I mean, traveling around and recording those stories and... trying to get a more permanent record of the things before they perish and so forth.
And so that kind of idea that the culture that was being collected by Forche and others, these oral traditions that were allegedly kind of disappearing from the earth as things became more mechanized and modern, was absolutely a kind of guiding assumption of folklore study. The Grimms kind of pre-exist the kind of modern professionalization of folklore study in the universities when the tar baby is so important. But they're an absolutely essential precedent. And, you know, the Grimms have a lot of assumptions in common with Joel Chandler Harris and with others who were fascinated by the tar baby story in those years and who kind of came up with many of ideas about culture and cultural circulation that are still with us.
Right.
And they shaped those ideas around the tar baby story. And so this is what was so... This is when you asked about how I got started. I was like, that is so interesting. You know, people were debating at that time, does this story come from Africa? Was it brought by slaves to the New World? Or instead, was it invented by the Cherokee? Or was it invented in France? Was it invented in one of those places? And the fundamental question they were asking was, does culture, when it circulates, follow lines of racial descent? Or does it cross over lines of racial descent?
Well, and,
is culture racial? Is race cultural? That's a very basic question, and it's a question that was formed first around the story of the tar baby, and that was the kind of starting point for the book.
And I looked
Is the question even answerable? I mean, I'm curious. Is that question even answerable, or is it?
I don't think so. I don't think it is. And so that's part of why I think the story has remained a spur to thought, right? Mm-hmm. Because it's actually not the case. You know, those kind of concepts have been formed around the story, but part of the reason why it has remained did remain all the way through the 20th century central to cultural inquiry is precisely because those questions are unanswerable.
Well, I looked up Tar Baby in our anthology before our call, and we have four versions of it. We have the one that Al C. Forche collected, two Native American versions, one Biloxi and one Natchez, and then one a modern retelling in a play, which has some of the racier parts removed for the kids. These weren't for kids, you know, just for kids. You've got the rabbit having sex with the lion's wife in some of these stories and things like that.
They can be quite bawdy. They can be I mean, absolutely. That is, there's a long history of censoring them as they're being transcribed or reperformed for a whole bunch of reasons. But it's true that in their original form, as we understand it at least, they could be quite racy.
Back in the
that reminds me of when you said Bugs Bunny earlier. I'm sitting here thinking about the Trix rabbit. Silly rabbit, tricks are for kids. And that probably is another, at least a lineal sort of a descendant of that character. Wouldn't you imagine,
absolutely,
or at least the Père Lapin?
So a few years
ago,
Stephen and I live in Ruston, Louisiana, which has the Peach Festival. And the folks at Laura Plantation put together a puppet show of the Père Lapin stories, and we're traveling the state showing it to audiences. And they came here to show it at the Peach Festival, and the town fathers, who were also, of course, the church fathers, said, well, let's see it first before you put it on. They decided it was too much for Rustin. So it has been censored right here in my hometown.
It's a form of censorship, yeah.
So
interesting.
I have always heard that it was traced back to Senegal. What have you, what do you think of that theory?
You know, this is the thing, is that we honestly don't know. You know, the person who did the most thorough study of the origins of the story is this person named Aurelio Espinosa, who published a series of essays in the 1930s. He thought that it came from South Asia, from India.
Huh.
And so, but what I would say, I feel like if you look closely at the methodologies of these people, they can tell you some plausible stories, including Fourche. Fourche thought that the story came to Louisiana before it went to Georgia. He thought it came from France to Louisiana and then to Georgia.
Hmm.
I argue that all of these different itineraries that are imagined for the story are at best speculative and provisional. Because it's just not possible. If you know, what we do know for sure is that in the 1880s, suddenly, the story was discovered on five continents. And
wow.
The question of how it got to all of those places,
right.
You know, really blew, you know, they were like, well, how did that happen, right? You know,
right.
But it's really not the case, though, that you can kind of reverse engineer, you know, a story's trajectory. You can speculate about it. You can look at, there are some methodologies that people have used to think about how you can you know argue that this is evidence for a particular route of diffusion, but in a final sense, you know, to use that term again, it's kind of unanswerable, right?
Well,
it is interesting that people have been so obsessed with this question of how the story got where it was.
Well, it seems like the one that Fourche records, it's set in the savannah. You know,
mm-hmm.
The characters are the same characters you see in Lion King. You know, you've got the macaque who is the priest. Monkey, you know, the lion is the king, Buki, the hyena, and always they're digging a well, and rabbit's too lazy to dig the well. But Laura Plantation is across the street from this big tall levee, and if you walk up to the top of the levee, there is the Mississippi River. They have never had a drought. You know, a lot of times of the year, the river is actually above our heads, you know, and it's just a few meters of feet of dirt away from flooding us all. So where do you get the idea of Buki and lion and the drought? Well, it's not from Louisiana.
Except from oral tradition, I would suppose.
Right, I'm thinking their version probably did come down from Senegal, if not the other version.
And you know, and I should say about you know whether it's Senegal or somewhere else in the West. I mean, if I had to say what I believe, it would be that it comes probably from somewhere West Central Africa. But again, you know, I think that it's important that it's not something we can say for sure. The beginning with the well though is interesting because the thing about that is one of the classic openings of the story, right? Where you have the lapin or the rabbit. Who either refuses to contribute work to his community who's digging well, or refuses to cooperate with the Buki or the wolf. And so it's an interesting, I think it's interesting because it's a kind of, it's very much the same philosophical parable you see in Adam Smith and John Locke having to do with the natural right to property, right? And so this is one of the things that I'm really interested in thinking about the story. Yep. Exactly. And so, but that's, if you think about it for a second, that's wild, right? You know, this story is all over the place and it begins with this kind of parable thinking about the natural right to property. Kind of, it follows in many ways, you know, all of these colonial roots where these philosophical and legal ideas about property were taking, you know, were taking root. Other people were telling the story at the same time, asking, I think, many of the same questions about ownership, about property, about labor, you know, and people haven't tended to see those aspects of the story because they've been more interested in trying to confirm its itinerary or its kind of cultural, you know, its cultural attachment to a particular people. So I'm very interested in thinking about the story as a kind of vernacular philosophy. You know, I think that that's something that is profound about it that previously people haven't really paid attention to.
Compare Le Pen or, you know, Br'er Rabbit, the rabbit does not respect, you know, those boundaries. Like in the Native American versions, they start Americanizing it. In one version, he's there with a Frenchman instead of other animals, and he eats the potatoes. you know, that they require, mm-hmm. you know, he's eating the foliage, but they require the potatoes to live. And so, you know, he's eating that up as well as not digging the well. And in another version, he's digging up the corn to eat the roots. Well, they need the corn.
In other words, he's not producing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But not only that, mm-hmm. but he's mm-hmm. destroying, yeah. he's destroying mm-hmm. everybody else's production. Like the yearling, you know, they wind up shooting the yearling because it keeps mm-hmm. attacking their garden. Eating mm-hmm. food they need. So, and, you know, that's kind of rabbit's function in the world is, you know, a kind of a plague to come in mm-hmm. and eat your food.
Mm-hmm. How much does, from the European angle, we talked about the French a little bit, the possible French influence or whatever, French connection, so to speak, but what mm-hmm. about, I'm curious about the rabbit character and as being a trickster, as being almost like the Spanish picado or the rogue. Mm-hmm. Is there any kind of connection at all to the picaresque tradition as far as, or even a Spanish version of the story?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Or to, you can go in France, you know, to the Roman de Renard, you can go back. Again, it's the thing that's important and interesting to me, is that I think all of these things seem relevant. You know, they all seem connected. You know, it's kind of like what's happening is the discovery of global culture, right? Like we always talk about globalization and how we're all connected now. What people were discovering in the 1880s at the kind of really at the very beginnings of a certain kind of professional inquiry, in the interpretive sciences was the fact that we're all already connected. Already telling the same stories. And what is that about exactly? You know, that was the kind of question they were asking. So you can go to Spain or you can go to France, you can go to the Picaro, you can go to these other kinds of character types that have some clear genetic connections, but you can't draw lines for certain. And so that mystery, again, I think is something that has been so influential as people have tried, but, you know, ultimately failed, I think, to solve it over time. So it's, you know, my book is very much in some ways, it's a kind of meta history. It's a history of all the things that people have made of this story. I do also have, you know, at the end, there's an anthology with a dozen kind of examples of the story. And I talk a lot, you know, a lot about details of like what's happening in the Philippines, you know, in terms of like, you know, different kinds of agricultural production at the moment the story is happening. So I try to put it into particular context and give the details of particular stories. But at the same time, it really is the subtitle, you know, A Global History. It tries to think about all these times and places at once through the lens of this story that seems like it was suddenly discovered to be everywhere, which is, I think, you know, intellectually really exciting.
And if it was not European in origin, it shows how, even as the colonialism was going forward, there was also this blowback. You know, they were bringing stuff back mm-hmm. with them, and not just mm-hmm. materials to use, but ideas and stories. And mm-hmm. So in the Philippines, was there a well in that version too? Like, every version I've read has a well.
Yeah. It's another very common beginning. It actually concerns a man named Masoy and an ape. And Masoy, it is different in content, but actually structurally the same. Masoy spends all of his time growing fruits and vegetables, right? You know, and then the trickster steals them. So it's very similar. It's also a story that's about private property in that case. The thing I think is so interesting about the way the story is set up is that clearly our identification and sympathy is supposed to be with the trickster or with the rabbit or with Compère Lapin. Mm-hmm. But if you look at how this kind of parable works in political philosophy or in political economy, you're supposed to be obviously sympathizing with the person who's working hard, who's having the fruit of his labor stolen from him. Right. And so this is for me, I have a long explanation of the book about how actually the story is thinking through the stakes of these new ideas about property, but from the opposite perspective that you find mm-hmm. in the European philosophical tradition. And so the identification with the trickster, which a lot of people has kind of taken for granted as obvious, I think is actually something that's kind of fascinating about the story, because it's working through these very same scenarios in which the right to private property is being derived in European legal history at the same time in the same colonial places, but it's coming to opposite conclusions about the justice of colonial acquisition, mm-hmm. about the justice of slavery. Right? It is a kind of counter philosophical tradition that is global in scope, just as the legal and philosophical traditions it contests are also global in scope in those centuries.
Which compels using a rogue, right? Because the rogue is an outsider. So it compels
That's
the storyteller
right.
to use that kind of character. I mean, you wouldn't use an establishment character to tell a story. You have to use this rogue character to tell a story.
Compère Lapin doesn't just disrespect private property. He almost, in the versions I've seen, he also disrespects the common good, the idea of coming together to build something we all need, water, but he won't put in any work, but then he wants to come along and freeload off of it. So I'm
very interested in the fact that those, sometimes you'll get both of those in the same story, but very often it is either private property. So in the Philippines, that's the version that you get, you know, with the fruits and vegetables, where it's actually the fact of the labor that you've devoted to transforming nature, that this is the Lockean formula, right? But then you're absolutely right to say that common property in other instances is the key issue. And it's, again, a kind of very familiar philosophical scenario. If you know the essay, the very famous Garrett Hardin essay, The Tragedy of the Commons, which is about people, the temptation to overgraze, right? You know, the philosophical problem of the fact that you can be what people, law and economics people call a free rider, which means that if everyone's building this well together, the rational thing to do is actually not to work on the well at all and just take the water anyway, right? And so this is seen as like a basic core philosophical problem that argues, in these instances, for the necessity of a state to protect private property. The point
and
that I would just make again
the,
is that, like, yeah, good, go ahead.
Look at the long history of the enclosure of the commons. Most recently, companies like Facebook, which took a thing that the people of the United States built as a government project, the internet, and took it over for private billions, you know, and he's basically, you know, they want you to come to Facebook and stay on Facebook and get everything from Facebook so that they can get money from that. Here's something, somebody else dug, and I'm not only going to drink from it, I'm going to put a wall around it and not let anybody else in.
Or pollute it, right? You know, in all of these variations.
The former CEO of Nestle, you know, you don't have a right to water.
Right, exactly.
Right? I mean, That's the most extreme.
Yep.
And he was at least, I'm like Ralph Nader, a hero of mine, but it's like Nader says, these people like him are doing a favor to the public because they're letting people know how the billionaire class think. This is how
they're making it clear. Yeah. But so you all put your finger on it. In a nutshell, the argument of the book, of my book, is, you know, that the Tar Baby is a story about the enclosure of the commons from the perspective of the people who have been dispossessed, right?
Right.
And it is cast as a philosophical parable, right? And this, to my mind, if we can't trace the itinerary of the story, we can, I think, hazard a guess about why it spread to so many different places, because I think it helped people to explain and understand a process of modernization in which the commons was being enclosed, in which that was previously available to everybody, was claimed as, exclusive property by a few. And I think that that's, you know, ultimately that kind of explanatory power is the best I can do to account for the story's global diffusion. And so it's a kind of amazing vernacular philosophy. And I'm not just, you know, that's not an interpretation on my part. Literally, the kinds of scenarios that the story chooses as a kind of opening gambit are the ones we're discussing, which are the same scenarios that are used in political economy to think about the kind of beginnings of private property and of the state. You know, and so it's not a reach to say that this story is addressing those very same questions.
And suddenly you've got these Europeans.
This is the attack that's been made through the Wizard of Oz. If you heard this Frank Baum's series of stories and the real powerful in the novel and to a degree on the screen too, but in the novel, those are the robber barons and particularly the owners of the railroads, like Jay Gould. And so, and all the munchkins Absolutely. Are the little people. Those are the common people, you see. And they're more or less having to settle for whatever they can get as the crumbs from Jay Gould's table or anybody else's table that's one of the robber barons.
And if you look back at when this story was emerging, when it first would have been incubating, let's say, certainly it was circulating among slaves who suddenly, not only was their labor not there, and their bodies were not there.
Mm-hmm.
And here these people coming right. along and stealing our bodies from us and stealing us from the place we belong. It's, you know, and the only thing they have, since they can't, well, I mean, they can use force. We talked about Broad Coupe last time and mm-hmm. probably the German Coast Uprising, but you will almost always wind up dead that way. So practically speaking, 95% of the time, your mode of resistance is trickery. And so you need mm-hmm. trickster figures to show you the way.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think that's exactly right. I'm going to need to go in a minute, and I want to tell
okay.
you I have three things that are happening now,
yes,
or that have come out that I want to be sure to tell you all about. Because one is actually about Brock Coupe. So I wrote about Brock Coupe in a chapter in my first book that came out in 2009, Disturbing the Peace.
Right,
but 3 weeks ago, LSU Press published an anthology that I did. And I have to tell you the title. I like the title. It's long though. The title is The Life and Legend of Brock Coupe,
cool.
the Fugitive Slave Who Fought the Law, Ruled the Swamp, Danced at Congo Square, invented jazz, and died for love.
Wow!
That sounds like
it's a long. I had to convince the press that that title was a good idea, but I think
right.
we've all come around to it. But it has a long introduction. It has a lot of new research. It has facsimile
good.
Documents, original police records, the payment of the reward, newspaper articles, all kinds of things. It has maps. Of New Orleans and the swamp behind New Orleans in the 1830s when Brock Coupe was there. And it has been an anthology of all of the major versions of that story, both historical versions, but also in folklore, in literature,
table.
And otherwise. So,
yeah, table
is there. Everything's there. Bichet is there. It took a while to get the rights to all of those materials, but they're all there. LSU Press published it at the beginning of March. I'm very happy with that. So that happened. I also have a website that's about to launch. I think next week or the week after. It's called Louisiana Slave Conspiracies. It's
cool.
about the Pointe Coupe conspiracies of 1791 and 1795.
Mm-hmm.
We have more than 1,000 pages of facsimile documents from the conspiracy trials. There are two trials in 1791,
wow.
two in 1795. They're all transcribed and translated. We made a map of Pointe Coupe in the early 1790s, which was a long process. We have
Did
a census
have a-
of all individuals involved. It will all be there. I'll tell you the address. It will be long. You know, if you all don't put this up for about a week, the site will
it'll
be live
of
when
months
people hear
before
this.
Post,
oh, hey. Well, then it'll definitely be live. So if people go to lsc.berkeley.edu, or if you just Google Louisiana slave conspiracies, you can see the site. It's very much set up right now as a platform for collaboration, you know, so that people can help us to refine our translations and transcriptions,
cool.
can pose research queries. The people
right.
of New Roads are so passionate about their local history, and they've been such
sure.
great partners. In putting this project together, so that's
Did you
happening.
Have a grant for this is a huge amount of
yes.
work.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, and not only that, but also if people go to the website, they'll see that I am part of a massive team of people, and I'm
right.
kind of like the least interesting person. I'm the person who writes grants and you know coordinates people, and everyone else does the really interesting and challenging work. But so that is up. But then one other thing is that in the fall, there's a book series called the 33 and a Third series. Each book in the series is about a single record album. There are
oh,
about
cool.
250 books in the series so far. It's great. But I have a book on the Wild Chops Hoolis album of 1976
oh, wow.
Yeah. coming out in that series. So that will be out in October. So I've been doing, it's I've been doing for,
wow.
for whatever reason, about 3 years ago,
horse.
I started to
You've
do
a workhorse.
I've been working hard, but working on, you know, my home state, you know,
right.
I'm kind of turning back out to write a book about Reconstruction right now, but I went through a good phase of work, kind of thinking about my home in a lot of ways.
Well,
so this year, it's really all coming to fruition.
We're working on Dubois' account of Reconstruction in Louisiana. It was a very anomalous state compared to the other states because we had an educated, free, fairly prosperous people of color who were ready to move into spots of responsibility. And so what part of Louisiana were you from?
I grew up in New Orleans. The Tribune, L'Union, like all of those people, the people who eventually advanced the case of Homer Plessy. I think it's anomalous, you know, the situation of Reconstruction in Louisiana, but also Oscar Dunn. There are all these amazing heroes and characters of that time. I think it's anomalous, but there are also ways in which I think Reconstruction makes a different kind of sense when you put the story of Louisiana at its center. You know, I think that the kind of claims that were being made, I think, so forcefully at that time, especially, you know, in and around New Orleans, are important and can kind of help to frame the entire political experiment. So that's what I'm trying to think about it now, but that's a broader kind of project. But my three Louisiana projects from this year, the Brock Coupe book, the Wild Child Batulis book, and the Louisiana Slave Conspiracies website. I'm very excited about all of them, and I'm kind of spending some time trying to encourage people to engage with them.
We would like to have insurrections. Did anybody ever take those events and turn them into songs, or ballads particularly? Are you aware of anything like that?
Which events do you mean?
Yeah, the insurrections from the late 18th century. Did anybody ever take those and memorialize them as songs or song lyrics?
It's a really interesting question because there's a song about Saint-Malo that some people think might actually be about the 1795 conspiracy or connected to it. A historian, Gilbert Dinn, has thought about that. And so we don't have otherwise. You know, I think there may be some things that are of more recent vintage. And we have, you know, some kinds of, you know, popular histories and stuff from the 19th century that are mostly trying to hush it up or kind of like racist, kind of distortions of the events. But we don't actually have it's interesting that we don't have a significant documentary record of the kind that we have, for 1811. You know, there's one newspaper article connected to 1795. There's only one newspaper in the territory at that time. So it's one of the challenges of thinking about those conspiracies that, you know, really most of what you have to go on are these court documents, which are complicated. You know, they're kind of self-contradictory. They're very inconclusive. And so the question of, you know, what it means to turn you know, those kinds of unreliable sources into historical evidence. It's quite an interesting methodological problem that historians interested in slave conspiracies of many kinds, you know, such as, say, Denmark VC's conspiracy in Charleston in 1822, have really wrestled with the question of what do you do with those kinds of sources.
Mm-hmm. I was wondering, because I had read something in a music history book years ago that the historian said that if you want to see where events, you know, pass into popular consciousness very quickly, go and read, for example, something like song lyrics, because what happens is events occur, and oftentimes then right afterwards somebody will memorialize it as a song or commemorate it as a song.
Absolutely.
It makes sense that somebody might have turned this into a song of some sort. I mean, you know, to try to at least capture the memory of the thing, the memory of the event.
I would say they almost certainly did. It's just that we don't have record of it. You know, like it would be very surprising to me if that did not happen. We just, in this particular case, don't have those. And it would be great if we had those kinds of records or other kinds of more reliable sources to think about the conspiracies. But we don't. So we're forced to kind of try and pick through the thicket of these court documents instead.
Which requires some really patient legwork and also some careful analysis after you once collected the stuff, I'm sure.
Indeed. And so that's actually part of what we're asking people to help us with. You know, we don't at this point have a lot of exposition or other kinds of, we're working on different kinds of network visualizations for the website. But at this point, you know, it's not, we're not quite there yet with those things. So we're hoping that people will start to ask us questions, you know, pose queries as we continue to think through the conspiracy. So far, it's very much a kind of documentary project. You know, we're getting the materials out. And we're doing the best we can to make them legible to people, but we're hoping it's a platform for collaboration is how we're pitching it. So we're hoping that interested and informed users.
Were these in Spanish or?
It's Spanish and French. Multilingualism, you know, as you know, is a very complicated matter in the 1790s in Louisiana. It's even the case actually in 1791, the first trial. You have a judge, investigator, and scribe, all the same person, Valentin LeBlanc, who's writing. He's conducting the trial in Creole French, but transcribing it in Spanish, and he doesn't really have very good Spanish. So it raises all these questions about, you know, a command of legalese and a language you don't speak very well. But that first trial was also challenged. The second trial in New Orleans in 1791 happens because some slave masters raised questions about the first trial, and eventually in the second trial, the slaves claim that they don't actually speak Creole French. They speak Mina, which is an African language. And so the whole question of whether the first trial was valid hinges on language and hinges on multilingualism. So it's absolutely the case that it's really a fundamental part of our project. Our lead for linguistics is a woman named Janelle Thomas, who teaches at Oxford, who works on the Bouligny family, and, you know, is an expert in multilingualism in late 18th century Louisiana. So everything that comes up, she makes the kind of final call on these kinds of questions. But it's a really kind of complex set of circumstances, just beginning with, you know, leaving aside, you know, all the questions of political organization, of knowledge, you know, of kind of forensic evidence, just the mere kind of language and the process by which these court documents were created is itself, you know, I think just endlessly fascinating.
Right. And where have these documents been housed? Are they in New Orleans, like in the archive? Or?
So they're in different places. There is one trial in the clerk of court's office in Pointe-Coupée. There is another trial in the Louisiana History Center at the New Orleans Jazz Museum in New Orleans. There is another trial that is in the General Archive of the Indies in Seville. And there's another trial in the Notarial Archives in New Orleans. So we had to get permission from all of those people and digitize the documents to put them online. So kind of bringing those together is maybe the kind of first contribution we've made.
Right.
Were there any documents that were like in the hands of any descendants at all, or have y'all been able to get lucky?
Because of the great collaboration we've had from people, some people have come forward. I can't really talk about it right now, but we will soon have some documents available online that are in private hands. Again, as I said, you know, especially in New Roads, but also, you know, elsewhere, as, you know, we've been doing the project, it's great to have people in the community who are so knowledgeable about their history and so passionate about their history as collaborators. It's meant the world to us. I need to run, but it was as always a pleasure to chat with you all, and I'd be happy to do it again.
And one more time, the name of your
The Brock Coupe book? Yeah. The Tar Baby book. The Tar Baby book is called The Tar Baby, A Global History. It was published by Princeton University Press in 2017. It's available in independent bookstores, online outlets, all over the place. And actually, you know what? I just remembered that it is out in paperback very soon.
Good.
So that's an opportunity for people. Yeah.
Is there a Kindle version?
Oh my gosh. I think so. I should know the answer to that question offhand,
right?
Shouldn't I? But I believe there is. Yes.
Well, and how about audio? Is there like my mom likes to listen to books on?
I don't think that there is an audio version of that book. There will be an audio version of my Wild Chapatulas book. I feel like that's the first time any of my work has gone into that medium. So not yet, but who knows? You know, I'm also love to listen to audiobooks, and so I feel a little bit of trepidation about what it would be like for my prose to be read aloud. I love it. Oh, absolutely, and I'm part of that audience. So I wouldn't be averse to it at all.
Well, thank you so much for stopping in today. We know this has been a real labor of love for you to, you know, conduct this kind of research and get it out to people, and certainly for people that are going to do their own, you know, not just research but also pleasurable reading about a really famous Louisiana character. It's, you know, really great to get you on and have you talk about it and, you know, make available to our listeners what you've done. So we really appreciate it.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, I appreciate you all taking the time. It was great talking to you.
Yeah. Well, you take care then.
Okay. Glad you all take care today. Too. Thank you.
See you later. Thanks.
Uh-huh.
All right.
Bye-bye. Bye.
We want to thank Brian for coming on our podcast and making another trip back to the porch. Certainly every time he's on, we learn a lot. And
absolutely.
I'm fascinated by his research areas, especially the one we're talking about this week, The Tar Baby. And you can pick a copy of it up online or the fine bookstore near you.
Yes, yes.
For the Louisiana Anthology Podcast, I'm Bruce McGee.
And I'm Steve Payne. We certainly want to thank Brian for stopping in and discussing The Tar Baby with us. He's been quite a long time since he's been on the show.
3 years.
Yeah, 3 years, almost exactly. So we want to thank him for stopping back and visiting with us again. We also want to thank all of you for listening in on our chat. We hope that you'll join us for next week's edition of the Louisiana Anthology Podcast. Bye for now.